because these are necessary steps on the path, on the spiritual path. But then you take it further, yeah? And this is kind of the remarkable thing again about the Buddhist path, is that you experience already a lot of happiness and tranquility and contentment. Sometimes just watching the breath peacefully can be very wonderful in itself. And then you move on, and there's more, and there's more, and there's more. You go deeper and deeper, become more and more peaceful. And I like the way Ajahn Ram, who sometimes put it, says that sometimes there comes a point you don't know how you can take any more bliss. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah? You don't know how you can take any more bliss. And then there's even more beyond that. Yeah? It's kind of one of those remarkable things about Buddhist meditation. You kind of keep going on. Things become more and more beautiful on this path. And sometimes you will hear people like Ajahn Ram, he talks about the jhanas and deep states of samadhi. And it takes very skilled meditator to attain these very profound things. Ajahn Brahm is one of the kind of rare masters of these kind of states. Never be disappointed because you cannot achieve a jhana state, because there's so much happiness, so much peace to be had long before you even get there. Just enjoy whatever you have, and as you enjoy each step on this path, the path just takes you further, further down the line. You know, things become even more peaceful, even more beautiful. And one day, of course, if you keep on improving, one day the big, kind of really big things start happening in your life. And that's when things really get turned upside down for you for the first time. And it's a beautiful upside down. Nothing to be worried about. The whole thing is just very, very wonderful and marvelous. So then, when you then experience the rapture, you just keep on watching the breath. Again, there's nothing you have to do. Yeah, the next state is always within the previous one. All you do is you keep on the passive observer, and you just keep on being aware. And if the mind is ready, and this is really the critical thing, whether the mind is ready or not, depending on how much you've been practicing, how long you've been practicing for, and all these kind of things, then by itself it will move on from the more coarser rapture to even more refined happiness, with deeper tranquility, deeper sense of peace. Yeah, the peace is deeper, and the happiness is more profound. The one-pointedness or the unification of mind is more, is even more. There's less distractions from the outside. This is how you recognize these states, some of the qualities of these things. More and more unified, more happiness, and more tranquility, more peace as you go into these things. All qualities that we all really seeking for, because they are so powerful. They really are very attractive qualities that everybody, I don't know anyone who could not, I think everybody aspires for these kind of things. So this is what pleasure is. You move from rapture to pleasure. One is piti, one is sukha. They're just degrees of happiness, different depths of happiness. And the next one it has here, it says, it trains thus. I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. Mental formation, citta sankhara in the Pali language. And the citta sankhara is again another way of talking about the qualities of the mind. The feeling that you experience, the perception you have at this particular point. Yeah? So you experience, you just have this experience of bliss and happiness. It's just another way of talking about that. It doesn't really add, I think, all that much to the previous two. And then you continue the tranquilization of what you have already. It's already very beautiful, already very peaceful. But then you keep on calming down even more by being even more passive than before. Just observing, just being aware. Things pacify, and they pacify even more. And this is this last step here, when he talks about breathing in, tranquilizing the mental formation. Things becoming even more still than they have been so far. Yeah, so many of these things are the kind of things you really, you know, you have to experience these things as you go along. And for those of you who haven't experienced any of this, it's just wonderful to know that these things are available. If you practice in the right way, it's going to happen. You can't stop it. It's non-self, yeah? So if you just practice in the right way, this is going to happen to you. So if you don't want it, tough luck, because you're going to have it anyway. But you want it, right? Well, how can anyone not want this? It's like saying, it's so obvious that people want this. So you do that. And then, so that is the second tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta, the one which is equivalent to the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah? So you can see all about positive feelings that we contemplate or that we are aware of. So Vedana Nupassana, it's enough to contemplate the good feelings in life. And then the bad feelings, we can just forget about. If you just follow this path, straight to the good feelings. Quite handy to know that. Then we come to the next tetrad. The next tetrad, now we're moving on to the mind contemplation. This is called the Citta Nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. So we're now moving to from feelings to the mind, how to contemplate the mind itself. And this is what this is about. So I'll read this out to you first of all and then comment on it a bit afterwards. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, concentrating or stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So again, very repetitive, but the advantage of repetition is that those things that change for each repetition, they kind of stand out. It makes it very easy to know what to focus on here. Has a nice rhythm to it. It gives you a bit of time to absorb the message, yeah, when it's so repetitive. That's one of the nice things about this. So here the first thing is about experiencing the mind. And the idea here is that when everything becomes peaceful enough, all those things that are extra apart from the mind, they start to disappear. So what is it that is apart from the mind? And what is apart from the mind are the senses, the external five senses, if you like. In Buddhism, the mind itself is considered to be a sense. So it is the external five senses that kind of die down and start to disappear, and you're left with the mind, the sixth sense, if you wish. So this is what is meant here by experiencing the mind. The external world is starting to fade away quite strongly here. There may still be some input from the external world, maybe some noises occasionally, whatever. But really the external world is starting to fade away. The body is like very distant, and then you would barely be able to feel the body at all at this particular stage. Everything fading away. And this is how we kind of, you know what the mind is. Yeah, when the external things fall away and only the mind is left, that is how you know what the mind is all about. So here we are transitioning, making a transition from like worldly phenomena that belong to the five senses, to mental phenomena. And one of the characteristics of this mental phenomena that you will have heard people like Ajahn Brahm talk a lot about is the idea of a nimitta. Nimitta is like often like a light in the mind. Yeah? And when you get to this stage again, every stage of the path is more blissful and more happy here. And this is like a very, very, even more blissful than before here. Like a powerful light. You know, sometimes people experience like the sun. Yeah, and they kind of, there's a beautiful story. There's a story I heard a few years ago about, I think she was a Vietnamese immigrant to Perth. And she was used to going to the Kuan Yin temples in Vietnam. And when she came to, not to Perth, to Melbourne, I think it was, but she went to the Vietnamese temple in Melbourne because there are quite a few Vietnamese people or Vietnamese background people in Australia. And of course, she's used to going to Kuan Yin, yeah, and this, as part of Buddhism, we pray to Kuan Yin a bit like Christians pray to God. This is kind of one of the things about Mahayana Buddhism. So she went to this Kuan Yin temple and she kind of went down there, and very, a lot of faith, a lot of confidence in Buddhism. So she came in, she didn't know anyone, she saw the Kuan Yin statue, she went over to bow down to the Kuan Yin statue, and she saw this light, this brilliant light, yeah, very, very powerful light. And then she tried to put her hands in front of her face because the light was so strong, it was like the sun. But still, even when she had her hands in front of her face, she still could see the light. And this is what you then very likely was a nimitta. It was one of these very, very powerful lights when you have so much faith and so much happiness of finally coming to a refuge, place of refuge for you, a monastery where you kind of feel at home and you feel happy, and you come back to the Kuan Yin statue and you feel this overwhelming positive feeling, yeah? And you see this brilliant light, so brilliant, oh no, I can't bear it anymore. But actually, in your mind, it doesn't help to put up your hands, it's not going to make any difference, yeah? But this is what it can feel like, very powerful and very, very almost blinding. But of course, it's not blinding, because you're not actually seeing it with the physical eyes. So this is what's happening at this stage. And then a lot of what happens here in this tetrad, which is the contemplation of the mind, is actually knowing how to deal with these nimittas. Nimitta means a sign or a mark. It's a sign of the mind, a mark of the mind. So how to deal with this in the nimitta and take it even beyond, even further. Yeah? So how do we deal with this nimitta? So what it says, the next thing, once you start experiencing the mind, the next thing is to gladden it. Initially, the nimitta may not be very powerful. So by staying with it, again, not doing anything at all, but just staying with it, not moving, just being the passive observer, it gladdens by itself, becomes even more blissful, even more tranquil, all of these qualities going together. And then from that gladdening of the nimitta, by staying with it, you get the stilling of that nimitta. Again, just a process happening by itself. The more passive you are, the more able you are to just observe. It happens by itself. This is what is called the concentrating. I'm not allowed to say that, so I say stilling here. So I say stilling, then stilling the mind. Yeah, things becoming incredibly peaceful, very, very one-pointed. The purpose here is to get to a point where everything is absolutely still. Nothing is moving. All there is just bliss, bliss, bliss. Nothing else is happening here. So passive observing, that's all you have to do. And then eventually, if you keep on carrying on that passive observation long enough, allow the bliss to build up, the peace, the stillness to build up, there comes a point when you enter the states called the jhana states. And that is the meaning of here, of liberating the mind. You're liberating the mind, this is called vimochayang chittang, related to the word vimutti in Pali, you're liberating the mind. What are you liberating it from? You're liberating it from karma loka, the world of the five senses. The five senses, bang, are gone, and all you are left with is a purely mental world. Also liberated from all the five hindrances, and the mind is free. You feel this powerful sense of freedom in these particular states. So that is where this mindfulness of breathing leads. Yeah, anyone who doesn't want to practice mindfulness of breathing? Anyone? Sounds good, right? So this is kind of what it's all about. So it is very powerful. It's also a very interesting journey. You start to really feel the meaning of life. Yeah, now you start to feel what the meaning of life is all about. Everything else just seems ridiculous in comparison. So this is gradual shift in what you value and what is important to you, things that matter. And of course, eventually you end up becoming, you end up living your life differently because of these kind of experiences. So that is the path of calming the mind down. And as part of that path, there's also a high degree of insight comes with that as well. Throughout this whole process, to be able to do this process properly, sometimes you need to reflect on what is going on. What are the problems? What is stopping me from going further? Why am I plateauing at this particular point? What can I do to move on to the next step? So insight is kind of, at this particular point, is really about deepening your samadhi, your ability to become still and peaceful, is what it is to a large extent about. If you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, that is exactly what it says. It says you focus your insight on things like the five hindrances, to understand them. And of course, the purpose of understanding them is to overcome them. So insight is focused on this ability to take your meditation to a deeper stage. But after these deep meditations, then insight is actually focused on uncovering the nature of the mind and the nature of reality, what is called Yathabhuta Naradasana in Pali, which means seeing things according to reality. So knowledge and vision according to reality is what that means. And this is the next step here, the last tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta. Now we're moving into the realm of insight. So let me just again read this out to you, and then I shall comment on it in a second here. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. So this, you can probably get the feel that this is a little bit, sounds more like insight, yeah? It's about impermanence, anicca in Pali language, very well-known word. It's like, you know, Buddhism 101, anicca, one of the first things you hear about in Buddhism. And the fading away, viraga, then you have nirodha, which is cessation, and patinissaga, which is the relinquishment. And these are all terms that are, to some extent, quite very related to each other. So anicca is just the idea, things are impermanent, things are kind of not stable, they're always moving, always changing, nothing is really, nothing is the same all the time. So anicca is a very broad term meaning impermanence, unreliable, unstable. Viraga means things are literally fading away and disappearing. Yeah, so gradually things are just fading away, becoming less and less, until eventually they cease, nirodha. That's the third one here. So these are powerful aspects of impermanence. Impermanence can just be an up and down thing, but impermanence can also be the complete ending of things. So nirodha is like a profound aspect of impermanence, when things really cease. And the last one here is relinquishment. Relinquishment means when you give up something by eliminating craving and desire for it, it's completely gone. And this is what we really mean by liberation in Buddhism. When you give up the complete desire and craving for things, you are liberated from that because you no longer want it anymore. So what exactly, how do we apply this? It says here, okay, you contemplate anicca, but exactly how does this work? Yeah. What exactly do we contemplate as anicca? And of course, the most obvious thing that we here contemplate as anicca is precisely the process that we have just been talking about. Yeah, the process of watching the breath, because that process shows us impermanence very clearly. When you look back upon that process, when you had a deep meditation, what you will be able to see with a degree of clarity, depending on how deep your meditation is, you will see how precisely how things are impermanent, how they fade away, how eventually they cease. Yeah, you can see it with your body. Even just by sitting peacefully, after a while, you can't feel your body so much anymore. It starts to disappear. The deeper your meditation is, the less there is of your body, the less there is of your senses. All the five senses gradually disappear as the meditation becomes more profound. Then certain feelings start to disappear. You don't have any painful feelings anymore. All you're experiencing is joy. Then the joy transforms itself and becomes more subtle and more refined until even that kind of starts to fade away. So the feelings are impermanent. You can see how the feelings are transforming themselves in your meditation. You can see the mind, the defilements of the mind. If you watch the defilements very carefully, they are also declining. The more, the greater the joy is, the less there is of the defilements. There is an inversely proportional relationship. I learned this in engineering school because I was an engineer, rather than just kind of using some of that terminology. Inversely proportional relationship between the defilements and the happiness that you experience. Less defilements you have, the more joy you have. The more joy you have, the less defilements you have. You can see the decline of these defilements in the mind, and the kind of the negative states, all kind of disappearing gradually. And so this is what we contemplate. Yeah, this becomes like the ground for our insight, our own experience. Not some kind of idea in our head. Oh, yeah, five khandhas, okay, what are they again? Perception, okay, perception is impermanent. But that kind of doesn't really help you very much, perception is impermanent. What helps is when you see perception being impermanent inside of yourself, certain perceptions disappear. The perception of body is gone. Can't feel the body anymore. That means perception of body is gone. Perception is impermanent. Feelings disappear. They're no longer there. Feelings are impermanent. Yeah. This is what it means to contemplate impermanence, fading away and cessation. It is not just a purely theoretical thing. It's something based on your own experience. And very often people ask, the question is very interesting because, again, you know, one of the very basic ideas in Buddhism is the idea of the five khandhas, the five aspects of personality. This is how the Buddha divides a person up. And he says we can be looked upon in this particular way, as, you know, the physical aspect or the rupa aspect, the material aspect, if you like, feeling aspect, which means whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, perception, the will and consciousness. So these are the five things. And very often people ask, and I find it fascinating that people ask this question, and that is, what does that actually mean? Okay, I sort of understand feeling, I kind of understand perception, but then what? What exactly are these five khandhas? It's interesting because really, on the one hand, it is kind of very basic Buddhist idea that we divide the world up in this way here. But at the same time, it's kind of hard to grasp because it seems very theoretical. How do we actually deal with this? And this is what we are seeing right here in this sutta. What we are seeing, what we are contemplating here, when we are contemplating our own experience as we do the breath contemplation, that is just the contemplation of the five khandhas. That's what it is. Yeah? Nothing else. Because our experience, the experience that you have in this moment right now, is precisely an experience of these five khandhas, these five aspects of personality. And you see that those aspects of personality change. They fade away, they disappear. Yeah? And as you see that, you're actually starting to get an insight into these five khandhas as a consequence. That's all it is. Five khandhas is just experience, and just a particular way of dividing up experience. It's a skillful way of doing it, because the point is to ultimately to uncover things like non-self, to see that there is no essence there, yeah? And to be able to do that, you have to look in the right places. So the Buddha is telling us these are the places where you should be looking. These are the places that you should contemplate, because that is how you uncover this sense of self that we have. And you see that it's just an illusion. You have to look in the right place, though. So this is what this contemplation is about. And you can do this to some extent, yeah, already early on. Every time you come out of a meditation, it's always good to ask yourself, what happened? How did it work? What, you know, I always try to make it a habit to think at the end of the meditation, well, did it work or did it not work? And if it worked, why did it work? And you start to, after a while, to realize that there is a certain way of looking at things that enables the meditation to work. Try to figure out what those things are. And as you do that, you know, you become skilled at this process of meditation for yourself, and you can take charge of your own meditation practice as a consequence. That is what happens at that stage. So again, you can use the insight throughout this thing, but it becomes powerful, more powerful, the deeper your meditation is. And after a deep state of samadhi, that is when these insights become particularly powerful. Why? Because so much of the world has disappeared. And when you contemplate that, you start to understand where, again, happiness really lies, where contentment really lies, and where it is not to be found. Okay. So that is the very last one is then the contemplation of relinquishment. And that is when you take these insights to almost to the culmination. When you keep on contemplating these things again and again, ultimately, in the end, your craving, your desire for all of this disappears completely. And when craving goes completely, then you have, this is the meaning of relinquishment in Pali here. You relinquish the world, means you have no attachment to it anymore. You have no desire and craving for these things, because now you understand where true happiness lies. Okay, anyway, that's way down. That's almost at the end of the path. The Buddha says at the very end here, because that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. So that is the Anapanasati Sutta for you. It is that's just an extract. It's actually a much longer sutta, but this is like the main core, the main part of it, and the part that really tells you how the meditation experience is to unfold. So this is a map for you to keep in mind, to kind of remind you what this path is about, hopefully also to inspire you a little bit. This is one of the things that I find about these things, when you understand what they are about. These sutras are very inspiring. They kind of draw you in, and they almost oblige you to follow once you start to understand what this is all about. Thing about all of this, the thing which kind of frustrates people is how to get there. Yes, maybe it is there. There's no reason to really doubt these things. I know too many people who get these kind of things. It's very obvious that these things actually exist. They are just natural cause and effect things. Yeah. But why then, every time we sit down, how come we don't feel blissed out every time we sit down and do nothing? What's going on there? And this is kind of the really crucial question. And this is the question that we all need to resolve. And once we can resolve that question, then we're actually starting to enable ourselves to access these particular states for every one of us. So what is that? What is the kind of the critical issue that really matters? And the critical issue that matters, I touched on that very briefly yesterday, is when you see the Buddha sequence of causality, how meditation works as a first person experience, the psychology of meditation. It always starts out with one thing. And the one thing it starts out with is sila in Pali. The word sila in Pali means a number of things, but the main meaning of it is basically something like morality. Actually, morality is too narrow. It means more than that. But really, it comes down, if you like, to morality in a certain way of looking at it. So this is what we have to do. And the reason why we don't access these things is because basically we haven't purified our morality enough. That's really what it comes down to. And this is not, I don't mean by this to say that, people are very immoral. That's not really the point. Or, this is not to kind of blame yourself for being a bad person. If you don't experience bliss, it means you're bad. That's not what it means. That would be terrible. That's not what it means at all. What it means, rather, is just that morality has many, many different levels to it. And we can always purify our morality a little bit more. We may already be living really well, but can we do a bit more in our lives? And this is really the question here. And when we talk about morality in Buddhism, we usually talk about three kinds of morality. We talk about the morality of the body, how we treat others physically. Morality of speech, and this kind of fits in with kind of ordinary Western ideas of morality as well. But there's also the flip side of the coin. It's not morality in Buddhism. It's not just about avoiding doing the wrong things, but it's also about actively doing the right things. So when I was talking earlier on this morning about the idea of bringing joy into the practice, if you actively do good things, if you actively do kindness, if you actively say kind things to others, then you are building up that storehouse of good actions inside of you that you can then rely on when it comes to the meditation practice. So these are the two sides of morality, speech and action. Avoiding the bad and actually positively doing the good things. But there's a third aspect of Buddhist morality, and that is the aspect of how we use our minds. And this is kind of where Buddhist morality goes way beyond ordinary ideas of what morality is about. mind is not usually included in the realm of morality, but in Buddhism it is. So we should actively pursue the purification of our own minds. And if you pursue that systematically in the right way, that is where you can really do a big change inside of yourself and to enable meditation to really take off in the future. So this is what I want to talk about next a little bit. How can we actually actively encourage that change in the mind? Now I have given you the carrot. Yeah, so the carrot is kind of, this is what can happen if you practice in the right way. And now comes the means to actually achieve that carrot. Or at least some of those means. We can't talk about all of those means because it's a very short retreat, only a weekend. Just enough to get a little bit of inspiration and relaxation. Still, I want to talk a little bit about that because it is so crucial. Some of the suttas I'm going to talk about now are the suttas that I talk about again on every single retreat because they are so essential, so foundational for how this whole path actually works. And of course, if we're going to talk about defilements of the mind, how to overcome defilements, the most important defilement to focus on is the defilement of ill will, anger, negativity, and all of this, because it is something that affects almost everybody. It's very rare to find people who hardly ever get some degree of anger and ill will. But very often, people say that they would like to overcome their anger and ill will, and to move beyond that, but very often people find it difficult. Very often people kind of make resolutions not to be angry so much, but they haven't really got the skillful means to enable them to move beyond these things. So it's very important to do this in the right way, in a way which actually works properly, which actually eliminates it in a systematic way. And of course, this is where the Buddha comes in, and the Buddha has some very interesting advice to give about this. So let's start this sutta. I'm not sure how far we're going to get, but let's at least have a look at the next sutta. It's called Removing Resentment, I have always found this sutta particularly powerful and very useful in practice. And this is how it goes. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends, bhikkhus, friend, those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment or ill will, if you like, by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So that is the summary of the sutta. And here we have Venerable Sariputta. He was the Buddha's right-hand monk. Sometimes you can see him on the shrine. We haven't got Venerable Sariputta here. He always sits like this. If you see a monk on the shrine sitting like this, then no, it's Venerable Sariputta. This is how he is kind of, what he looks like when he's on the shrine. Mahamoggallana is always like this. Venerable Sariputta is like this. Not sure why that is, but that's the way it is. This is called iconography. You know, the icons, how they are kind of, Anyway, so that's Venerable Sariputta. So he says, friends, bhikkhus. And then he gives the summary of this teaching. And what you will see in that summary, which is interesting here, is that if you look at all of those five kinds of people, you will find out that everyone, every person, any conceivable person is included in those five categories. Yeah? There's no one who's excluded. So there's no excuses, yeah? It's not like, yeah, actually, well, I met that anger towards, you know, I can remove anger towards everyone except for this one person. It doesn't really work like that. The idea in Buddhism is to remove it towards everyone. And in fact, this is one of those things. If you're going to have success in your spiritual practice, you can't really afford to have ill will or anger towards anybody. Yeah? And this is what this is about. So we need to strive towards that. And sometimes people have some very traumatic experiences in their lives. And that can make it sometimes very problematic to give up all anger and negativity towards certain people. But you can move towards that goal. We can always reduce, yeah? So never think of the goal as being impossible. Think instead of how can I move a little bit towards it. If we look at the goal, it may seem inconceivable to be able to do that. But if you just move a little bit in the right direction, then you're already doing something positive. And maybe one day you'll be completely rid of it. It's possible. Yeah? But the point here, we cannot really afford, according to Buddhist teachings, to have ill will or anger towards anyone, because it is a massive block in our own lives and in our own meditation practice. This sutta tells us how to overcome this. So I always remind myself that, when I talk to someone, maybe they could be upsetting if I looked upon them in the wrong way. Yeah, if I now can see myself kind of veering towards irritation and negativity. And I always remind myself that I can't really afford to get angry and upset with anyone. Maybe I could die later in the afternoon. Yeah, imagine I came in here, I sat down and started abusing all of you. That would be terrible, wouldn't it? And then I went back to my room, I was thinking, oh no, what have I done? I've abused all these good Buddhists, and then I die of a heart attack, and I feel really bad about myself because I die of a heart attack afterwards. Yeah, so imagine that. And this is the thing, we cannot really afford to do anything wrong or say anything wrong or even think anything wrong, because there's always this chance that we might die or things might come to an end, and there's no restitution, there's no way of kind of making up for what happened anymore. Yeah, so I promise to do my best to be kind to all of you, otherwise I might be in trouble later on. And this is a very beautiful way of thinking. It's almost like bringing the sense of death into your life here and now. Can never afford that possibility of being saying the wrong thing to people, or doing the wrong thing, or even thinking the wrong thing. So these are then these five ways. And the first one goes as follows. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is impure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Yeah, very simple, right? Very, very kind of straightforward. The idea here is that people are complex. People have many different aspects to them. Lots of people have many good qualities. Most people also have some bad qualities. It's up to us what we focus on. Yeah, we can focus on the good stuff. We can focus on the bad stuff. Too often we focus on the bad stuff. Too often it's too easy to think about the bad things in other people. So the only way that you're going to be able to focus on the good stuff is to retrain your mind to actually see the good things rather than negative things. And this is why I was saying, when you come on a retreat like this, always look at the people around you and see that big picture. Yeah, people come here not because they want to be nasty and negative and destroy the world. They come here for the opposite reason, because they want to be a blessing for themselves and the world around them. That's why all of you are here, I guess. If you're not, then And I find this is just what happens when people go on retreats. Yeah. This is just the way it is. Because of that, you learn to focus on that, and you don't take it so seriously when people make little mistakes and do little stupid things. That is really all it means. When anyone in any Buddhist community who practices Buddhism seriously, keeping the five precepts, sometimes keeping the eight, sometimes going meditation retreats, sometimes doing acts of charity, all of this is just so wonderful. And it's so easy when you look around, those people that you hang out with in the Buddhist community. This is why it's so great to have Buddhist friends, yeah? Because they think a bit like you. It's easy to see the good things in them. And so we have this opportunity to see the positive in people around us. So please do that. Be active in seeing the good things in people. And then it's so easy to excuse and to forgive the little negative things, because the big picture is far more important than the small negative things that come out sometimes in daily life. Remember the big picture. And remember that it's easy to forgive the small stuff. So this is how this works. And sometimes people say, but is that being realistic? I must block pretending that they are good when actually they're quite bad, you know, they do these negative things. Actually not so good after all. I'm just pretending. So how can I be, shouldn't we be realistic in Buddhism? Isn't it about seeing things according to reality? Isn't that the whole point? And the answer to that is that there is no reality as far as other people are concerned. You don't know what other people are like, yeah? People are always changing. Sometimes people are very saintly, and other times they may be in a low mood or whatever, and they act badly. But in the end, you don't really know anything about other people. You don't know about their overall life or their overall virtue and all of these kind of things. It's very, very hard to know these things. So because of that, there is really only one standard that we can use, and that is the standard, what is actually useful? That is the best standard to use when you decide how to look at other people. Because we cannot know them, because there is no real reality. Of course, we'd like to think that we see them as they actually are, but we don't. We don't see them as they actually are. We see them according to our own predilections, our own conditioning, our own defilements, our own biases. That's how we see them. Difficult to see that in yourself. That's actually what's going on. So instead, ask yourself, what is useful? What perception can I build up that will enhance my spiritual practice and also be a help to the people around me? And that is seeing the positive in the people around you. That is what is useful, because then you're actually building up spiritual qualities inside of you. So forget about trying to be realistic. There is no such thing as being realistic in regarding other people. All there is whether something is useful or not. And then you are heading in the right direction. And this is why somebody like Ajahn Brahm, he's incredibly forgiving. This is one of the kind of standout qualities for me with Ajahn Brahm, is that he never holds on to anything. Absolutely not. I live with him for 23 years now, and I can assure you there's nothing that he ever holds on to in any way whatsoever. You can abuse him. You can do whatever you like. And I wouldn't recommend abusing him, but you can, you know, if you did, and sometimes I have said things to him, right, that hasn't been exactly respectful, to be perfectly honest. And because I was kind of maybe upset about something, especially in my early years at Bodhinyana Monastery, I might be upset about something. But listen, Ajahn, this is right, or whatever. But he never holds on to anything. Then you meet him the next time, a few hours later, or the day later. He's just as if nothing ever happened. Yeah. And this is the remarkable thing about somebody like that, giving straight away, giving things, no holding on to anything. And this is the sort of practice that we're seeing in this particular sutta, always remembering the good qualities around you, in the people around you. And when you do that, you can forgive so fast and so quickly. So let's have a quick look at the simile here. The simile here is very useful, and it shows you how this actually works. So you have a ragged-robed bhikkhu, monk, and the ragged-robed monks, they're the ones who kind of go along the street side, and then they see a rag on in the gutter along the street. They take out the rag, yeah, take it back home, and they're so happy to find the rag in the gutter. And they kind of dry it, wash it, clean it, iron it, and then sew it into their robes. This is a rag robe bhikkhu. So the robes look really really rough. So he sees this rag by the roadside, yeah, and he's very pleased with that. So he presses the rag down with his left foot, spreads it out with his right foot. He tears off an intact section and takes that with him. So spreading it out with the left foot is like, this is a bit like, you can imagine, you're spreading the person out, seeing all their qualities, yeah, all the qualities from all the various aspects, the good ones, the bad ones, whatever you see in there. Remember, this is not real. This is just your perception of that person, yeah? So you spread it out like that, and then when you see all the qualities in that person, you tear off that part of the cloth which is useless. The cloth that you cannot use, you tear it off. Just in the same way, you tear off, you pull away all the negative qualities. You take that cloth, you chuck it out because it's rubbish. In the same way, all those qualities of that person are rubbish too. You throw them out because they are useless. They are useless as far as the spiritual path is concerned. And that's why you throw them out. And then you take that clean cloth, you take all the beautiful qualities, you take them into your heart. You carry them with you, yeah. And whenever there is a challenge in the future, that person does something strange, you bring those qualities out again and you remind yourself of all the good qualities in that person. So this is the ideal way. Carry with you inside your mind, in your perception, carry with you the good qualities of the people around you. And especially you will find that there are certain people in your life that are more difficult to have positive perceptions about than others. It's always like that, yeah? Okay, the Buddha, it's quite easy to have positive perception about the Buddha. You know, not least because he's passed away, yeah? That kind of helps. Anyone who's passed away, it's easy to have positive perception about them. But even the Buddha, people even were even angry at the Buddha when he was around. But the main thing is to use these kind of techniques for people who are a little bit more difficult. Yeah, people who are good, but they are difficult nonetheless. And as you do that, you can change your perception of people dramatically just by following these kind of simple techniques. But it takes time. Yeah, this is one of the things about all spiritual practice. It never happens overnight. It's not done like that. So you have to keep on at it again and again and again to remind yourself again and again, because habits are hard to change. We have a habitual viewpoint of other people, and it takes time to change our habits. So remind yourself again and again and again. Focus on those good qualities that they are there. Yeah, and often it's easier to do that when you are away from the person, when they're around you. So if you are now away from some difficult people, this is your chance now to develop those positive qualities. Remind yourself of those positive qualities and build them up inside of you. And as you do that, after a while, you start seeing those and you can forgive the negative things. Very powerful and very beautiful way of dealing with things. Let's just move on to the next one. It's very similar, but it has another nice simile which is worthwhile bringing out as well. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have just a different aspect of the person. Instead of the body, now it's the verbal behavior. Yeah. So it's just that people are different. We need to learn to focus on different things. That's really all it means. So there's nothing, I don't think it I don't think it means that there is any particular distinction between verbal behavior and bodily behavior, just any behavior which happens to be good, that's where you put your attention. But what is distinctive about the second one is actually the simile here, because the simile is a bit different. So here you have the pond. The pond is like a person, yeah? A person is covered with algae and water plants, and these are all the negative qualities that you see in that person. So when you see someone who's a bit wrong, you can tell, oh, you're covered with algae and water plants today. I can tell. It's a nice hint, right? Not being too direct about something not being quite right. And then someone comes, a man arrives, yeah, afflicted and oppressed by the heat. And heat in Buddhism, and being weary and thirsty and all of this, this is a metaphor for anger or ill will. You feel hot inside. We all know what that is like, yeah? So this actually means that somebody has ill will. So if you have ill will and somebody has negative qualities, what happens? It ignites that ill will even more, yeah? You see the negative in somebody and you're already in a bad mood. Oh no, don't want to see that. And it flares up because it's already kind of going wrong. If you are full of metta, it's not an issue, yeah? If you're full of metta, people can have all kind of negative qualities and you can kind of smile and you can... There's no worries. But if you already kind of incline in the wrong direction, oh, it is bad news. And then it really flares up as a consequence. So what do you do then? You are thirsty. What does it mean to be thirsty in this case? Really, what it means is that you're trying to get that anger, that ill will to die down. Yeah? So you really want to get rid of that anger if you're practicing the right way. So you're trying to quench that heat inside of you. Huh? And so how do you quench that heat inside of you? Huh? And what you do is you plunge into the pond. You sweep away the algae and the water plants. Yeah, you sweep away those negative qualities. You don't look at them. You place your attention somewhere else. You change your perception of what is going on. You learn to look at the thing in a different way. And by learning to look at the thing in a different way, the person differently, all of that disappears. And then, when you have swept away the negative qualities, you drink the water with your cupped hands. Because what remains, when the bad qualities are gone, what remains are the pure qualities. You drink those in. Yeah. Because you drink them in, it means obviously you carry them with you afterwards. So you drink them in, it cools you down. When you have the good, cool water in the same way, it cools down the ill will and anger when you take on board all the good qualities and the people around you. Yeah, so this is what happens here. It's a wonderful, wonderful, nice little simile about how to deal with these kind of with difficulties in life and difficult situations. So this is what we have to do. To add to that, and actually this comes more further down, but one of the things that we need to do very often as well is also to learn how to forgive the bad qualities. Yeah, and this is one of the such an important thing to learn to be able to forgive the bad qualities in people. And one of the most powerful ways for me to do that is always to remind myself that people are conditioned to be the way they are. They don't really have much choice. Yeah, if people do bad things, they do negative things, they say something which is stupid, they are unpleasant or whatever, the reason they are like that is not because they want to be unpleasant. I want to be a menace to the world. Nobody thinks like that. We all want to do something positive. But very often we can't help ourselves. Yeah, and this of course comes in the end, it comes from the specific Buddhist idea of non-self, that we are in fact very much the product of our past conditioning. You know, in this life for sure, but of course in Buddhism also coming from past lives as well. And because we are the product of past conditioning, and that is really all we are, it means that past conditioning, that is what determines our actions, our speech, how we are. So remember that when you see somebody doing something which isn't quite right, remember the reason why they're doing that is because of them. Yeah, because of their conditioning, because of their background, because their personality has been formed in this particular way. And you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, so you had to kind of bear the brunt of that action, of that negativity, whatever it is that comes out of this person. Got nothing to do with you. The reason why you get upset is always because you think it's personal.
they are being bad towards me. Yeah, I don't deserve this. This is wrong. Why are they doing it towards me? It's not personal at all. It is all it is their conditioning. It's got nothing to do with you as a person. Their conditioning is the problem. And very often, and this is kind of almost like the tragedy of it in a sense, very often people want to do the right thing. They want to be kind. They want to be nice. They want to say the right thing at the right time. But they can't stop themselves. The conditioning, the past is so powerful that it overrides all your ability to restrain yourself and hold back and do those silly things. And when you think about it that way, then actually they probably want to be kind. I mean, don't we all know that kindness is equivalent to happiness? I know when I'm kind to somebody, I feel good about it. I know that kindness and happiness are very closely related to each other. If I'm nasty towards somebody, I try to avoid that. I hope I'm not too nasty to my fellow monks. But so I know that I feel good about it. I think everybody has that as an intuition inside of us, yeah? That we feel good about ourselves when we are kind. Kindness and happiness, very closely linked. So it's one of the tragedies, in a sense, of humanity, is that we're not able often to live up to those things that we know is the right way to live, to make our own lives happy and a blessing for ourselves. So when you look at it that way, you see people as wanting to be kind, wanting to do the right thing, but actually being unable because of the conditioning here. Then you start to turn the table around completely. Instead of getting upset, you actually have compassion for them instead. Yeah, this is so powerful. This is incredibly powerful stuff. This is like going to the core of the Buddhist teachings. This is non-self. Non-self is one of the most profound aspects of Buddhism if you take it all the way to its conclusion. But even if you can use it in much more simpler terms. Use it just to be kind, if you use it in the way I'm talking about now. All of these profound teachings have repercussions in our daily practice, how we live, if we think about them in the right way. So all of these teachings, very useful. Yeah, and if you use them in the right way, they're very, very powerful. If you think like this and keep on doing it, yeah, again and again and again, time after time, with person after person, after a while you start to see that your anger dissipates. You don't take things so personally anymore. You see other people doing bad things. You know, it's them. It's nothing to do with you. It's their problem. They're the ones who will suffer because of that. They're the ones who are deluded. They're the ones who are conditioned this way. And you feel compassion instead of feeling anger and negativity. Incredibly powerful. So I would really recommend you to try to use some of these not perhaps simple but profound ways of dealing with these negative emotions. And as you do that, you will gradually be able to transform yourself to become a better person. Of course, mindfulness is a very important part of this, because mindfulness is what catches you and reminds you, now things are heading in the wrong direction, okay, what do I need to think? And then you change your perception in time before any negative things arise. Anyway, so that is just the beginning of that sutta. I better stop there, because as always, time goes quite fast, but I don't want to do too much also in one session. So that is enough for now, and I'll continue on the sutta tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. But also I'll be seeing you again this evening, so if you wish to come out this evening, we're doing some more meditation together and a Q&A session starting at 7:30 tonight. So we'll see you all then.